Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you, Stan, for organizing this lovely event, but also for allowing me to be part of it. It's truly an honor. And as Marco said, I have spent 1.5 years, a relatively short period of time, in your lab, almost 15 years ago, I think now, or maybe more than 15 years ago. But it has really been a defining period for me, and one that provided inspiration for basically the work that has kept me busy ever since. So, thank you for that. The question that has kept me busy for the past decade is the idea that the brain is essentially a sort of a prediction machine, an organ of prediction that doesn't just respond to inputs, but that tries to kind of be ahead of its inputs and anticipate them. And normally I could spend an entire lecture kind of like unpacking that point, but today I want to do something different. I want to venture a bit into language, music, some more uniquely human forms of prediction perhaps. So I'm just going to illustrate this notion rather than unpack it fully. One illustration that came out last year from the lab of Itzhak Fried, who incidentally sort of developed these electrodes that Florian Moorman was showing his beautiful data with in the last talk, is this paradigm. So here they were measuring from single units, maybe concept neurons, in the medial temporal lobe, while these humans that underwent pre-surgical mapping were viewing a series of pictures. And what they found was that at the beginning, when they were just presenting these images in a random fashion, that they could identify neurons that responded strongly to one concept and not to any of the others. But then what they did afterwards is that they created these temporal sequences where which you can see up here, sorry, I should say up there. So this kind of pyramid structure where if you would see, for example, this stimulus, it would be followed by this one or this one. And then from there, it would kind of like, it could follow any kind of path along this pyramid structure. And so there's a remarkable finding here is that not only sort of after people were incidentally exposed to this structure, so they didn't have to learn the structure, they just did some orthogonal task. So one thing you can see is that the neurons started responding less to their preferred stimulus. That could be just adaptation, I suppose. But the more interesting finding is that they started to respond more to an image that they were initially not tuned for, but that predicted the image that the neurons were tuned for. So this is what you could call sort of like a future-oriented response or a successor representation. And something rather similar we observed in our own lab when we were looking at a very different brain area. Here we're looking at the primary visual cortex, and we were presenting images, people with image sequences of dots in this case, so just a dot that would move not in a very sort of like regular fashion, or it was like highly overtrained, but not in any way that would have like a low minimum description length. But then after people learned these kind of sequences, we would occasionally probe them with like a single dot to see like what would happen in the brain when you're just when people were just viewing the single dot. And here, a little bit like what the Itzhak Fried lab was showing, not only did we find sort of like strong activation in the visual cortex that had its receptive field on that dot, but here again we saw also activity in other visual cortical regions that had their receptive field on successor locations. And here you can even see, so this is, here we have the linear trajectory rather than this pyramid structure. So it allows you to look a little bit further into the future. And you can see that there's this nice temporally discounted representation of the future visible even at the level of V1. So what I wanted to talk about today is the question about like what the brain might be predicting in those cases. Now, just to give you a few definitions of prediction, what I mean with that is a sort of an extrapolation on the basis of some model that you have to data that you have not observed yet. And these internal models, they might actually have many different forms. So they could be a learned representation of both the statistical structure that is there in the environment, as well as sort of the causal relationships that that exist between elements in the environment. So to give you examples of statistical structure, so here is a whole bunch of them, and this is indeed things that we've looked at a lot. So one of the statistical facts that you may learn about the world is just a simple frequency of different things. And we know the brain is exquisitely sensitive to this. Excuse me. related to familiarity responses. Stability is another form of statistical structure. So if I close my eyes and open it again, most of the world will be identical. So this is, of course, also something that the brain, it would be very useful to capitalize on this statistical structure. And there's also spatial and temporal context, which can take different forms. So another form that we have barely studied, but are actually quite interested in, is something that Nancy Kamish already touched upon in the first lecture, and Josh Tenenbaum will have the last word on in the final lecture of the symposium. And this is sort of the predictions that one can make based on the knowledge that one has about how things sort of work in the world, for example, intuitive physics. And just as an example, so here you can see like what you could say four predictions about that you could make about what happens simply based on like whether you think about gravity, whether you think about solidity and object permanence, as well as on like other features that you may model. And depending on the ingredients that your internal model here has, you might come to predict quite different things. So I think this is also like a very interesting form of prediction that we should learn more about. Now, how can we find out what the brain predicts? So of course, classically, what people have been doing is, for example, to let's look at behavior. And this is something that, especially in developmental psychology, has been beautiful work from, for example, René Baillargeon, also Liz Spelke, many others that look at things like looking times and use this as a readout of like surprise. So the degree to which something is unexpected. But of course, one can also, when one has those recordings, really like go into the brain and then sample not just whether an agent is surprised, but do this more at sort of a level below and try to understand like whether specific regions that are computing specific things are surprised by certain violations. And this is a study by David Schneider from NYU that I quite like, where they had these mice that were walking on a treadmill. And what they, the prediction that they generated was that whenever they would move their paw, there would be a specific tone pip that would ensue. And then after the mice have learned this, so it's a little bit like when they have their clogs on, so whenever they move, it makes a certain sound. You can see that when the predicted sound was played during running, the brain hardly responds. Whereas if you present the same sound when the mouse is not moving, there's like a very strong response. And at the same time, when the mouse is running but you present a different sound, you also get a strong response. So here, what you could infer from this is that the mouse might have been making sort of like tone-specific predictions contingent upon its paw movements. Okay, so this is just to wake us all up. So this is to illustrate that surprising events, depending on what you find humorous, or depending again on your internal model, can really trigger you and generate sometimes even an overt behavioral response. But again, so what I want to walk you through is some data where we look at the neural responses to various forms of surprises. And one of the very earliest, again, data points on this came from beautiful work by Marta Kutas with Steve Hilliard, where they discovered this so-called N400 for a situation where people got sentences like the milk was too cold to cry, or to eat, or to drink. And what you can see here is that there is this kind of like, well, you could call it a parametric response to the degree of surprise that is elicited by this last word in the sentence. But this kind of study, even though I think it's quite insightful, still begs the question of like, well, what was the surprise really about here? Is this a surprise about the specific semantic content of the last word? Perhaps it also carries some phonological features or syntactic features, perhaps even other features, pragmatic features. And this has been sort of one of the questions that particularly Misha Helbron, a former grad student in my lab, has been very interested in, to sort of see like how can we unpick what features of surprise is actually triggering the brain. Now, the way that, or the general approach that we took for this is to go actually away a little bit from this kind of lab experiments where we would have like carefully controlled 2x2 designs. Instead, what we would do, and that's what I'm going to give you an example of each of these three. So where we give participants much more rich, complex, semi-naturalistic input. For example, stories that people will be listening to, musical pieces that people listen to, or in this case, like more naturalistic, more complex visual input. Now, of course, we can give those stimuli to the brain and record activity over time. The innovation here is that we can also feed these kind of inputs to artificial neural networks these days. And sort of piggybacking on the success of these AI innovations, what we can ask different models to do, especially generative AI models, is to predict upcoming input based on past input. And that can give you sort of like a marker of the predictability in the input contingent on a specific processing model. And now, of course, what we can then do is compare the sort of surprise response, or the degree to which a neural network is surprised, to the degree to which humans are surprised, and use this as a way to see, sort of to test hypotheses. But now sort of like the AI models become hypotheses, if you will. And yeah, as I said, Misha Helbron has really been spearheading this approach. So all the data that I'll be showing you today is also in collaboration with him. He is now an assistant professor in Amsterdam. And to start off with language, so I think we all know now that due to ChatGPT, etc., that if we give these models a particular context, such as, for example, it made the boy sad too, that these networks are really good at sort of making contextual predictions about what the next lexical item in this case could be. So in this case, this is just a snippet that we took from a book, from the Old Man and the Sea, highly recommended. And then upon this, hearing this context, this is sort of the candidate words that the model predicts, with the bar sort of indicating how probable it thinks each of these candidates are. But now the more interesting thing we can do, rather than just taking these lexical predictions at surface value, is to try to actually analyze those distributions and try to unpack or unfold, if you will, these kind of lexical predictions into predictions about different feature spaces. So for example, when we take these lexical predictions and do a POS tagging on them, what you can see is that basically all sort of the first candidates are verbs. So in other words, in terms of a syntactic prediction, upon hearing this, it's quite likely that the next token is going to be a verb rather than an adjective or an adverb. Similarly, we can also look at the semantic embeddings of this prediction, predictive distribution. So we can see like what kind of semantics are predicted by, for example, using a GloVe or a Word2Vec semantic embedding, a distributional embedding similar to what Florian was showing as well. And that can give you a sort of a semantic prediction that you can then compare with your input. So you can generate a semantic surprise. And finally, you could do a pronunciation lookup on the basis of these predictions and derive phonemic predictions. So that's kind of, I think, the beauty of this approach, that you're not limited to just looking at like what your generative AI model predicts, but you can then sort of also further unpick that and get sort of like a very high conceptual resolution in terms of like what features the model might be predicting. All right, so the very short story of this paper, where Misha applied this approach to humans that were listening to language, was that all these forms of surprisal are actually present in the brain with distinct topographies and distinct temporal windows. So we see a reflection of morphosyntactic surprisal quite early on. We see a semantic prediction error very late, actually, so surprisingly late, much later than the N400. But perhaps that's also due to the fact that lexical surprisal was sort of also modeled in the same model here. So some of the N400 findings on semantic errors might also be due to this kind of like more general lexical surprisal. And we also find a phonemic a reflection of phonemic surprisal. So this is, I think, interesting, and it's also showing us that then sort of like from a high level prediction of like what upcoming tokens, that this is kind of like unpacked into this all these different levels of prediction in a hierarchical organization. All right, so in a follow-up study, we are doing something that is, yeah, potentially a little bit silly. We just started doing this, but of course, so what I've shown you in the previous slide is that when you're a native listener, so in this case there were English native listeners that were listening to an English audiobook, then you find back this whole hierarchy of linguistic predictions. But so the follow-up question that we had is like, well, what would a completely naive listener predict or be surprised by? And in this case, the operationalization is a Chinese audiobook. So I believe it's Bai Yu Luan, for those of you who know Chinese. So in this case, the sentences, I will not even dare to pronounce it, but this is the pinyin representation of the sentences of the audiobook that, in this case, Dutch listeners were subjected to. Now, you might think like, okay, that doesn't make any sense. Why would we be surprised or why would we make any kind of predictions? But sort of an inspiration for this project came from this kind of already very old finding by Jenny Safran and colleagues, which many of you know, I think, which found that even 8-month-old infants, and subsequent work, I think, has pushed the boundary even to much earlier ages, kind of are sensitive or become sensitive very quickly to statistical dependencies in input. So in this case, after having this three-syllable inputs that were structured, 2 minutes of listening to this structured input already generated sort of a sensitivity in these infants. So, and I think here the sensitivity was assessed by looking times, but in this case, we have in a way perhaps a more sensitive readout, because the adults did not have to do anything. They could just passively listen while we sort of like record the degree to which their brain is surprised by the input. So that's why we thought like, okay, maybe we have there is some chance that this might extrapolate to the real world and to a real language, which is of course also full of regularities at all kind of different levels. So first we thought, okay, let's first see if we can replicate the findings in English in Chinese, just to make sure that the input itself is not a problem. And that's absolutely possible. So when we had Chinese people listening to a Mandarin audiobook, what we found is that the MEG data was best described by a model that included all these different regressors for onsets at all these different sort of levels of lexical organization, so ranging from phoneme to subsyllable to word and character. And also we found that surprisal, so here it's ordered in the order of importance, particularly subsyllabic, character, and word surprisal in this case, were necessary to or helped to explain the brain data in Chinese individuals listening to Chinese. So this is like an encoding model approach, where like a higher correlation basically means that that regressor helps to kind of understand or predict in held out data the MEG response. And here you can see the temporal response functions of those different regressors. So you can see that there is a response to surprise at most of these levels. So now what about our Dutch people? Well, to start with the good news, we can see that that here again, having the onsets at these different levels of granularity actually helped there as well to model the brain response while they were listening to Chinese. So in that sense, we do get sort of like responses to phonemes, characters, subsyllabic units, etc. And all of these levels actually were relevant for explaining the brain response. But then when we look at this kind of like contextual surprisal that of course is strong predictor in Chinese, we see that there is absolutely none of these that have any effect in the Dutch cohort. Now this is in a sense almost a sanity check, because of course these Dutch people do not have a rich contextual representation of the tokens. So in that sense, it would have been maybe a little bit worrying if we would have seen an increase here. So, but now for us, this is really the starting point of the investigation, where we're going to look at like, okay, which model are those Dutch listeners actually employing? Where one possibility could be that they maybe just have a very simple statistical learning representation that kind of like unfolds as they're listening to this audiobook. Maybe they start to encode the frequencies of certain phonemes, or they might be just applying the wrong model. It's also possible that they're applying a Dutch model while they're listening to Chinese language. So those are kind of like all alternative and fun hypotheses that we can all throw at this data and to sort of see like which model best fits, in this case, the data. Okay, so moving to music then. I think music, I think, is a really fascinating piece of input to look at, because it has these kind of regularities that are learned over and applied over really like many orders of magnitude of time, in a sense. So, of course, when we are listening to a piece of music, at any moment of time, we're processing a specific note that is embedded in a certain motif that has like that is typically a few notes long. So there is this kind of local context. But then, of course, it goes way back to sort of there's like long range motifs within a musical piece. But even further than that, we have sort of enculturation that provides us with sort of like certain motifs that tend to occur in different pieces of music that we just learn through our cultural experience, and which may indeed be culture specific. And all of these forms of knowledge might, in principle, be encoded in the brain and therefore sort of like brought to bear on sensory processing of single tones. So we have structure at all these different scales from millisecond to lifetime. And our question here was like, well, if we were trying to sort of like see which types of influence are actually used when the brain is listening to music, yeah, that basically becomes the question. So what internal generative models might the brain use when it's listening to music? So this is work that was sort of done by a brilliant master student, P.S. Kern, and also in collaboration with Eelke Spaak. And what we did here is like we took music pieces that were monophonic. That was basically just to make sure that we could just predict one tone at a time. And then we had like a variety of computational models that in a sense differed in the degree or in their complexity that they use to make predictions about music. So in the interest of time, I'll just go through them very quickly. So, but the simplest model that we use is a temporally model, which is a Bayesian model that is based on sort of several interpretable principles established in musicology. So it can be seen as what you could call a gestalt model that embodies certain rules that music generally adheres to. Then sort of one step up, one order more complicated, is this idiom model, which is a sort of an n-gram model, a statistical learning model. And this idiom model also comes actually in two flavors. So you can base it either just on the input that was preceding the current tone. So then it's really an n-gram model based on short-term memory. But it can also be trained with long-term memory, and you can even have like a combination of those two things. So that's already quite sophisticated. But in our case, sort of the most powerful model that we applied here was a transformer model, but now for music. And this model, as you're probably all well familiar with, can really incorporate long-range structure, and it can learn also like which temporal dimensions of structure are most relevant for prediction. So, and we were already happy to see that these different models actually make different predictions. So we can see this in the simple accuracy. So here the accuracy is in predicting the music itself. So how well are these different models able to predict the next tone in a piece of music? The temporally model is not a chance. Chance level is here all the way to the left. But you can see that it is definitely a lot worse than these other models, where maybe the MT model is, together with this idiom STM model in this case, is performing the best. And also, so if you just look at how surprised the model is or how uncertain the model is, you can see that they're quite different. Perhaps most importantly for the current purposes, we can see that those predictions that the different models make are not catastrophically correlated. If they would all be making the same predictions about the pieces of music that we're going to show to our individuals, then of course it wouldn't be able to unpack which model fits better. But you can see the correlations are all positive, so they're all, they're not anti-correlated or anything like that, but the correlations are in the order of maximally 0.6. Okay, so now what we did is we, very similar to the language study, we had first a baseline model, which incorporated sort of the tones and repetition and some kind of like baseline factors that clearly explained the MEG data. And then we augmented the model with surprise generated by these different models. Just like we had lexical surprise before in our language study, so now we have musical surprise, but now contingent on these different models. And what you can already see here, it's maybe not super clear, but in this case, the surprise that you get from a transformer model, as well as this idiom long-term memory model, those seem to be sort of give rise to the sort of the best increase in performance in terms of like predicting the brain. So, but if we now zoom in on this music transformer model, I think that this is like the most interesting piece of data from this study. what we found is that that it mattered a lot for the improvement of the model, like which context length we gave the music transformer model. So, and here you can see this as like when we go back again to our ChatGPT model, you can ask it to make a prediction based on like how much tokens you give it in the past, right? Typically, the more tokens you give it in the past, the better it will predict. And that's indeed what you see here also for the when you ask the transformer to predict music itself. So the more context you give it, the higher the accuracy will be. So it will at some point, if you give it a very long context, it will be very accurate in predicting the musical tones. What you also see here, though, is that that's not the regime in which it's matching well, okay, what humans are surprised by. So here what you see is that the surprise that you get from a transformer model that has like 5 to 10 notes of context, that surprise is actually sort of like leading to the biggest kind of like improvement in brain encoding. So that suggests in this case that, and maybe unlike what Jean-Remy showed for some of the language models in general, that not the most performant model is always giving you also sort of the highest similarity to what humans are doing. And here, specifically when we're not just trying to encode the stimuli themselves, but rather sort of this more derived measure of like, well, what is the human brain surprised by and what are these network models surprised by? So this is data that we collected ourselves. There was also an open data set out there with completely different pieces of music, different participants, even different measurement technique. And we find that, we find a conceptual complete replication in that data set. So we are quite, suggestive of that this is really a robust finding. All right, in the last 5 minutes, I will move to maybe my, the thing that I'm usually dabble in most, vision, where I will share with you some recent insights in what predictions we are making in the visual modality. So for example, when you are here at Collège de France and then moving to a room like this, you might have sort of anticipated sort of the room before you already entered. Now, and there is some classical findings by the lab of Carl Olsen, who sadly passed away this year, where he shows that the same input can be sort of give to rise to a massively reduced neural activity when it's predicted by its predecessor compared to when it's not predicted by that predecessor. This is a form of statistical learning where they had this arbitrary pairings between two inputs. And here is some data also from monkeys, but now from V1, V4 in IT. This is from the lab of Peter Roefsema, collaboration with Peter, where we did exactly this, or we did a variant of this study. And we found sort of like pleasingly very much the same response here as well. We see a stronger response to unpredicted than predicted stimuli in actually not only in IT, where the Olsen lab is measured from, but also in V4 and also even in V1. Maybe somewhat peculiarly, you see this modulation even happening at identical time points, and that will become potentially relevant for the interpretation of what this surprise response is actually doing. You can see that it's really like much later than the initial transient in V1, whereas it's kind of like coinciding with the initial transient in IT. So maybe, which is going to be interesting as well. So we were curious about the question, like, well, what is the brain actually surprised by when it is, for example, seeing this sofa and then expecting this hourglass? And the two hypotheses that are quickly pit against each other is that one hypothesis could be that depends which brain region you are. If you are an early visual cortex region, maybe you're going to be surprised by things that just don't match in terms of those low-level properties. Whereas if you're a high-level region, you're going to be surprised by things that conceptually do mismatch with your expectations. Whereas the second hypothesis could be that maybe the system is just processing the input and then the surprise is generated at the top, and then from there broadcast to the rest of the brain. And under such a hypothesis, you would see high-level surprise throughout the brain. Now, the way that we try to look at this is by doing, again, a version of this statistical learning paradigm, but now we're not going to look at the difference between expected and unexpected. We're only going to look at the unexpected stimuli. And we carefully crafted sort of violations in which the violation was either a high-level or a low-level violation. So I don't have time to go into exactly how we did that, but I guess sort of you can see already that very simple example of this is that here you see there is no violation if you're expecting this guitar, but you see this guitar. In terms of high level concept, it's very much the same stimulus, but in terms of low level properties, it will be quite different. And you can kind of play this trick the other way around as well. And by then, okay, so what we then find is actually that in all the brain regions that we looked at, we see like a very strong modulation of activity as a function of how dissimilar the image is compared to the expected image in terms of high level similarity. High level similarity here is simply calculated as the Euclidean distance between the image representation or embedding in a convolutional neural network at a very high level, so the eighth layer of AlexNet. And you can see that there, if there is a strong Euclidean distance between what you expect and what you actually see, then you get a very strong response in both V1, LOC, and the higher visual cortex. So we have a few other models. So here we can see the Bolt modulation is very strong for this layer 8 surprise, not at all for layer 2. And we have another, also surprisingly, it's not related to sort of like a word-to-vec semantic distance. So in that sense, it does seem to be really still like living in a visual dimension, sort of like a high-level visual dimension, this surprise representation, rather than just the living in a dimension of like a cat is closer to a dog than a house, let's say. Okay, and this is, again, sort of like a visual representation of these findings. So the bottom-up tuning of the visual system to different layers of our neural network is very well described by what we know and what Jean-Rémy has also shown for the visual system. So here the you have to imagine all these dots, voxels kind of moving from the color bar to their locations, then it's exactly the same. And then, but what we see here is this prediction error effect completely doesn't follow that similar line. But here is like high level prediction errors all the way from low level to high level visual cortex. And we think that that's perhaps not very much in line with the classical notion of predictive coding, but maybe more in line with the idea that surprise is generated at the top and then broadcast, perhaps maybe via a Povenor mechanism or some other mechanism than cortico-cortical feedback, we think, which might also explain why we see that exactly the same latency at these different cortical areas rather than sort of like moving through the brain. Okay, my last slide. So we see this high-level surprise in low-level visual cortex in also in other settings. So this is an open data set that we reanalyzed from Martin Haybart as well, but the THINGS database, where we simply look at the activity to a stimulus as a function of what was shown before it. And there we again find sort of, in this case, that both low-level and high-level distance leads to more or less habituation in the early visual cortical areas. So that's suggestive of the early visual cortex not being just sensitive to surprise, if you will, here. This is like surprise under a stability prior, not just low level, but also high level distance. And finally, this is a study by Misha that we are currently finalizing, where we took data from the Allen Institute. These are mouse neuropixel recordings in V1. And look at spatial predictability. And here again, we find that sort of the bottom-up tuning nicely follows kind of this classical AlexNet hierarchical representation. Sorry, that the feature encoding in V1 is best predicted by a low-level feature, whereas the feature unpredictability effect that we see, sort of the stronger response for unpredictable features based on the contextual surround, the based on the spatial context, is best explained by this kind of like high-level surprise that you can get from higher levels of AlexNet. Okay, so these are my three conclusions. I think, I hope to have somewhat convinced you that the brain is using internal models to predict across time and space, that we can use AI models as hypotheses and quantify which models best approximate the internal models of humans by comparing their surprisal. And finally, that high-level predictions affect low-level neural processing. With that, I'm going to thank the people in my lab that did all the work, particularly so Misha has been really driving force of this work I present to you. And again, I'm going to thank Stan for this wonderful symposium and for allowing me to be part of it. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.